So nearly everybody would agree that we live in an age of consumerism. We live in a time in which everything revolves around consumers. During the crisis, we hear worries about consumer confidence. We hear that the world economy depends upon the spending mood of Americans. Yeah. Depending upon whether Americans are willing to go to the mall or not, whole economies can collapse or they can succeed. We hear that companies are constantly, and we see that, creating new and innovative products, new versions of old products, constantly new markets, all to satisfy the needs of the consumers. That's what we hear. We also know that shopping is one of the major hobbies, maybe the main hobby for most people nowadays. I was told that there's now travel firms that advertise trips to Dubai or other countries to do what? To go shopping. Yeah. To travel across the Atlantic, to go to New York, and to go shopping. And this is all generally taken as evidence that in this economy, it's all about consumers and their needs, consumers and their desires. If there is any disagreement about this issue, it doesn't deal with that point, but with whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. One group of people would say, well, the fact that everything revolves around consumers is proof that this is a very rational economy. It proves that people's needs, what they want, what they desire, are the purpose of everything. The other side, and perhaps that's the majority nowadays, would say that consumerism is a bad thing. It's not only dangerous, it's unethical. They would say that consumerism, that is, let's say, an obsession with consumption, an obsession with having more and more stuff, is the cause of many of the problems we see nowadays. Environmental destruction, poverty in the third world, even overwork and stress in the rich countries, the so-called rich countries. Both sides agree, it's all about consumerism. The disagreement is whether we should be happy about that or not. Tonight, I want to argue that both sides are wrong. I'll have a lot to say about that. But the main message I want to get across is relatively simple. Consumption is not the purpose of the modern market economy. Making money is. Second, that's why consumption is not the problem. Consumerism is not the problem. Many of the unpleasant things often attributed to what's called consumerism, overconsumption in the first world, is not due to people's materialism, people wanting to have stuff, but it's due to the irrational purpose of production in this society, which is to make money. So that's the general proof I want to deliver tonight. The talk is going to be divided into three parts. The first part, I want to talk about the objective role of consumption in capitalism. What role does consumption really play? The second part, I want to talk about the reality of consumerism. What does consumption look like in a market economy? And the third part, I want to spend some time talking about the notion of anti-consumerism, which is a more and more popular idea. Okay, first part, the objective role of consumption in capitalism. Think back to what you've been hearing during the economic crisis over the last several years now. There's been widespread worries about consumer confidence. Yeah. What does that mean? These are concerns about the fact that if people don't consume, if they're worried about not having a job in the future, then they'll be less willing to go out, make larger purchases, less willing to buy cars, to buy a house, buy a Christmas tree, buy all kinds of stuff. Now, why is that a problem? It's not the fact that people don't have the things that they want or need. That's not the problem when there's worries about consumer confidence. That's not the problem at all. What is considered a problem is that if people don't consume, then that's a threat to the economy. That's a threat to the growth and the expansion of production. It might seem obvious, but it's actually a really strange thing. That might be something everyone takes for granted. Yeah, if people don't consume, then the economy can't run. But in fact, that very fact characterizes the absurdity of the entire market economy. Think about it for a second. If the problem is that people don't consume, there can't be more production, then it turns out that production in this society is not a means for consumption. Yeah? Production is not the means where consumption is the aim. It's just the other way around. In this society, consumption is a means for production. Think of another illustration. What's the other reason why it's often said it's a problem if people don't consume? Well, if people don't consume, then companies can't make money, then companies can't create jobs. That's the big problem. Again, that might be something that most people take for granted, but that's in fact rather odd. In this society, why should people consume more? What's the purpose of having them consume more? Or let's say, encouraging them to consume more? So more people can do more work. I always thought that work is toil, it's sacrifice, it's a negative thing, something you want to minimize. Maximize consumption, minimize production. Here's just the other way around. Consumption is needed so that more and more production can happen. Here, the more work, the better. Well, how can that be? Certainly the purpose is not just to work for the sake of working. Not everyone's crazy and thinks that just work is the whole purpose. What that does tell us is that the purpose of work is not consumption. Rather, the purpose of work is to make money. And because that's the purpose of production, there can never be enough work. Now, one could say, so what? What's the problem? So what? It's all about money making. Everybody knows that. But isn't money making maybe the best incentive to produce for needs? If companies know that by producing more, they can make more money, well, then doesn't everybody win? Doesn't this mean more money for the one side, more goods for the other side? If consumption is a means for production, that's great. That means they want to have people consume. Everybody's happy. Not quite true. It's crucial to recognize in what sense consumption is a means for production. In what sense is consumption a means for making money? Not the fact that actually people satisfy their needs. It's not the fact that people live in homes. It's not the fact that people wear pairs of shoes, like I said, drive cars, live in homes, go on vacation. Not their actual consumption. That's meaningless. Consumption is a means for production because consumption always means you have to pay money in order to get a hold of all these things. Consumption's not the point. The point is that you have to pay in order to consume. That's why consumption is a means for production. Again, might sound obvious, but what does that mean? What does that imply? The first thing that implies, and this is the most drastic consequence, if people don't have money, if people don't have the money to pay for all these things, their consumption is meaningless. It's economically insignificant. That's the first refutation of the idea of consumerism. If people don't have money, they don't get a hold of the things they need. Clearly, means and ends don't harmonize here. Consumption might be a means for production, but not in the sense that people actually get to eat stuff or wear stuff, the fact that they have to pay money to do so. And if they can't pay money, their needs are worthless, so they don't get satisfied. And that, by the way, I could say as an aside, that's the entire explanation for modern poverty. It's that simple. Not a lack of goods, rather a lack of money in order to purchase those goods. So it's not a lack of production, a problem with production, it's the purpose of production that is the cause of poverty. Because it's about making money when it comes to production, people who don't have money don't get anything. Let me give you a better illustration of that. We're right in the middle of an economic crisis. Everybody knows that a crisis is a major problem. But what is actually an economic crisis? What does that consist in? Does that mean that there's not enough stuff? A lack of goods? Nonsense. Stores are overfilled. Companies complain about the fact that they have tons of goods that they can't get rid of. That's not the problem. That's not what an economic crisis means. Is it maybe a lack of the means to produce things that people need? Nonsense. Auto companies complain about excess capacity. We could produce tons of cars, but nobody wants to buy them. The problem is we have too much ability to produce things people need. Is it a lack of people in order to do the work? No. Mass unemployment. In fact, an economic crisis, and this is an absurdity that only capitalism can manage, An economic crisis does not mean a lack of all the things that are needed. In fact, it means there's too much of all that. Question is, too much for what? Clearly, not too much for people's needs. There can never be enough of that. Too much for the purpose of making money. And because all these goods, because goods, means of production, and people are currently not useful for making money, they are too many. There's too much stuff, too many means of production, and too many people. So, first refutation of consumerism. Second point. Like I said, consumption is important in the sense that it means people purchase stuff that they need. It's the fact that they pay money. That's why consumption is important. And one could still ask, if people's ability to pay for things is a means for the economy, why is there always a shortage of people's ability to pay? Why do companies always complain about not having enough customers? How does that come about? Even though it's a means, there's always too little of it. Why is that? Well, think about the source of most people's income. It's clear. Most people earn income by earning wages. They go to work for a company, and they earn a wage or a salary. But when do wages get paid? Of course, wages only get paid if they pay off for an entrepreneur. If a company reckons to make money by making use of your labor, then you get wages. If not, no income. Well, when does it pay off for companies to pay wages? Well, wages are useful for a company. They pay off for a company to the degree that they're very low and to the degree that people do a lot of work for them. What does that mean? Wages pay off for companies if people get as low as wages as possible. What that means is that their livelihood, their ability to consume, it's a negative thing. It's a cost factor. It's a deduction from the wealth that's really important. Think about that. How do companies succeed in business? If anybody reads the newspaper, watches television, or talks to anybody else, they know. You pay as low as wages as possible. Minimizing people's ability to consume is the way to success. What that means, in short, is that people's livelihoods, if they earn it all, get an ability to consume it all, it's only if they're useful for profit. And their usefulness for profit consists in them earning very little and working very much. Now, this fact, which one could describe as a contradiction between people's needs and companies' needs. Contradiction between people's needs for a livelihood and the company's desire to make profit. That contradiction is a contradiction for companies as well. By minimizing wages in relation to the amount of work that companies let people do, on the one hand, they can increase their profit margins, reduce their costs, and sell their goods. On the other hand, what it means is that they minimize the purchasing power that they can earn on the market. And it's that fact that has given rise to a very popular argument, one that we've also heard in the crisis, and very common among, mostly I'd say, unions and social democrats. And the idea is that, well, if companies would only pay higher wages, then people would have the means they need to consume. So if companies pay higher wages, then people can purchase more, and this is good for both sides. This is good for companies. Or if the government can intervene, let's say, create a minimum wage, so we'll also put more money in people's pockets, they can spend more, companies can make more, the economy is happy, everybody is happy. Three things I want to say about this idea, very widespread. The first point is that it's a false economic argument, but I'm just getting started. The second point is that it's never really intended seriously. And third, it's a very, very submissive argument, very, very subservient. First point, why is it a false economic argument? It's true. Companies want to make as much money as possible. That's why they always want other companies to pay more. Other companies should pay more wages. No company will pay wages himself. Other companies need to pay higher wages. Why is that? Well, it's because what I just said. For a company, wages, long before they're something a company wants to get a hold of, they're first of all a cost factor, a deduction from the wealth. That's why the purpose is to pay as little as possible. Now, if the purpose for them to pay higher wages is so that they can make money later, the idea is pay more money now, I make more money later. There's a much more safe way of doing that. That's to not pay out any money at all. If that's the purpose, if companies are to pay higher wages in order to earn more later, then they don't even expose themselves to the risk that money might flow elsewhere. They just keep it. That's why that argument is simply economically false. Both sides aren't happy. The contradiction remains between wages and profit interest. The second point is, I had said that this argument is never really intended seriously. Unions present this argument in order to demand 3 to 5% wage increases. Well, if the argument were true, if paying higher wages meant it was good for companies, why not ask for 100%, 200%, 300%? The more wages in the pockets of the workers, the better it is for companies. No, it's an argument used to pay, let's say, 3 to 5%. Apparently, the people who present this argument have a good deal of respect for the fact that people's wages, people's livelihoods, are first of all a cost factor for capital. That's something that they know, that's something that they recognize and say, yes, our usefulness for you is the fact that we earn a little and work a lot. And this would be the transition to my third point. The real basis of this argument is this subservience. To say, look, the workers are so useful for the companies. They're so useful for you because they work hard and don't ask for much. They could be also useful for you if they spent more money at your companies. That's my very quick run through the objective role of consumption in capitalism. The summary would be, it's not only the case that, as I started off, the consumption is a means for production. That would be absurd enough. What an upside-down world. It's not only the case that consumption is subordinated to production. Yeah, that's the point. If people don't have enough money, then they can't consume at all. If people can't satisfy the producer's need for profit, they can't buy anything, can't consume anything. So it's not only a means for production, for money-making, not only subordinated to money-making, it also stands in opposition to money-making. The less workers earn, better for profits. That's the objective role of consumption in capitalism. The next point I want to talk about is, well, what does consumption look like if it is a means for profit-making? What is the reality of consumerism? One point I'll be already mentioned is that if people don't have any money, they can't consume anything at all. They are economically meaningless. Well, how do capitalists make money? First of all, they offer products for various needs. Yeah, produce all kinds of things, make all kinds of different offers. Yeah, for all kinds of different consumer needs. The purpose, of course, is not to serve these people's needs, but to make use of their needs. You could even say exploit their needs in order to make money. Again, that means that those who don't have any money don't fulfill their needs. And that's why certain things aren't on offer at all. There are certain things you just can't buy. Can't buy plenty of free time with your family. Can't work out. There's no such thing as nice, clean apartments for everybody. Simply can't happen. Simply wouldn't be profitable. However, as we also know, anybody can walk through a supermarket or walk down the main shopping street in any city in Europe and America, and you find out that the market economy is characterized by an enormously broad spectrum of goods. An enormously broad spectrum of products, from high quality to low quality. Products at all different levels of prices and all different levels of quality. There's Mercedes and Dacia. There's low price and there's luxury. There's Prada bags and then there's 99-cent stores. There's brand name products and there's generic products. And usually that's considered a rather positive thing. Why? Because one says, there's something for everybody here. If you can't afford a Mercedes, well, you can get a smaller car. Not everybody can afford a Prada bag, so go and buy a generic bag. There's something for everybody here. All different kinds of needs, you can find the product that you want. Well, The problem with that idea, what makes it so wrong, is that these different levels of price and quality are not for different kinds of needs, but for they're for different levels of poverty. Think about it this way. In what sense does a 99-cent store correspond to somebody's specific needs? In what sense could somebody say, a 99-cent store, that's just for me. That's what I need. I don't need brand name goods. I need a generic good. Yeah, the only reason that that corresponds to their needs is because they can't afford anything else. That means it doesn't correspond to their needs. It corresponds to the size of their wallet. That's why the purpose and the result, both the purpose of this spectrum of price and quality and the result, is that companies manage to mobilize even the smallest amount of money for their needs, for their profit needs. That's why you can find the most luxurious oddities, the strangest things you can buy for the highest prices. On the other hand, stuff that you can buy, it doesn't function 30 seconds later. Yeah, maybe even the same version of the same product. Maybe it breaks right away. The purpose there is not to fulfill different kinds of needs. That's pretty clear. The purpose is to mobilize purchasing power at every level of the hierarchy, let's say the social hierarchy. The second point, something also everybody knows about, innovation. Companies are constantly bringing new and improved products out into the market, wholly new products that didn't exist before, new versions of old products. Again, this is often considered a reason to, let's say, to consider the market economy very rational. Look, they're always bringing out new and better products. What could be better? Satisfying more and more needs. Well, not quite true. It's true that there is constant innovation, constantly new products. But because the purpose of that innovation is not to satisfy new needs, but rather to make money, this process of innovation goes along with a whole lot of irrationalities. The first thing is, in a lot of cases, it doesn't really matter whether the new products are any different or any better than last year. Really, the point is just newness itself. My favorite example of this, I'm not sure if any of you have ever been in an American supermarket. It doesn't matter whether you're in a big city or in a small town. Thousands of different kinds of laundry detergent. Everyone says new and improved. Nobody could name the difference. Clearly, the purpose is not to develop, let's say, a more quality product, but just to point out something is new, something is different from everything else. Or think about cell phones. Remember, when was that? A few weeks ago, I read a study that I think 99% of the population can use maybe 15% of the functions that their cell phones have. I know that's at least the highest for me. Sure, I don't want to criticize the fact that you can do lots of things with them. What I want to point out is that that's certainly not the purpose of the product. All kinds of innovation, not there to serve different needs, but to have some kind of a sales argument. But that's, let's say, the most harmless thing about innovation when it's about making money. The second thing, innovation goes hand in hand with a remarkable waste of labor and resources. Plenty of products that are perfectly good for use, but since they're no longer competitive, maybe there's another product that's slightly better or has managed to have some kind of a sales argument for itself. They're no longer good for competition on the market, therefore they don't get used, therefore they get thrown out. And this is true for even for food, all the way up to computers. Tons of perfectly functioning things, cars, they don't get sold, they get thrown away. Not because they're not useful, not because there's no need for them, but because they're not useful for the means of for the purpose of making money. They get thrown out. Third point. Nowadays, companies even plan for that fact. Has anybody ever heard of the term planned obsolescence? Obsolescence is the noun form of the adjective obsolete. And what obsolete means is it's no longer state-of-the-art. Yeah. It's no longer the newest thing. It's superfluous. Planned obsolescence is this thing that actually everybody knows about. Companies have purposely designed things that can only function for so long so that they can sell them again. New computers. You could be that they just change one small microchip in the computer, throw the whole thing out, buy a new one. Lots of tricks. Make repair costs inordinately high, so it's just as easy to buy a new computer. Change a little bit, make people buy a whole thing. Don't let people repair them, make it difficult to repair them, allow them to buy or cause them to buy new product. Maybe the most famous example of this are so-called Terminator seeds from Monsanto. Has anybody ever heard of this? It's something where Monsanto, agricultural chemical company, designing seeds that are sterile after 1 year. So the purpose is to buy them again. Now, I'm sure everybody knows about this example. Lots of people get horribly upset about it. This is really considered a general scandal. But what I want to point out is that the same principle is at work everywhere. This innovation is not for the purpose of, let's say, satisfying needs. It's for the purpose of making use of those needs in order to sell new products. Here the example, or here the result, is an enormous waste of labor. Enormous waste of labor and resources. Yeah, that's part of modern innovation, if it's about making money. And the important point to recognize is this waste is not because of excessive materialism, not because people simply want to have, let's say, stuff, or more and more stuff. The interest is to take advantage of that, even the most basic materialism, in order to make money. It's not because people want to have more stuff that that happens. It's because the interest is in taking advantage of those needs in order to make more money. That's why innovation doesn't go hand in hand with lots and lots of fulfilled needs. Lots of people get the newest stuff. Tons of people can't afford any of it. There you can see, it's not about people's materialism. That only counts if they have the money. This is important. I think it's an important point to emphasize, because often it's the case, if I make these points, a lot of people would agree, say, yeah, modern consumerism is horrible. All kinds of useless products. They produce things people don't even need. They even create artificial needs, needs that people don't really have. And the point I want to make is, in and of itself, the creation of new needs is not a bad thing. Why should that be a problem? That's actually pretty normal. Any need that goes beyond, let's say, drinking and eating is an artificial need, something that comes from the society you live in. Part of the development of productive forces, the ability to produce more and more goods, is that new needs get developed. I don't see the problem. The problem is not the needs, but the purpose for which they're taken advantage of. That's where their irrationalities come from. Again, that's why so many artificial needs don't get fulfilled at all, so many basic needs don't get fulfilled at all, and even the luxurious, strangest needs get fulfilled perfectly if there's plenty of money there. This is a point I want to come back to towards the end of the talk when I talk about the notion of anti-consumerism. So, these are yet two features of modern consumerism. The first one was this broad spectrum of price and quality. The second one is constant innovation. The third point is probably most familiar to everybody: advertisements and commercials as far as the eye can see. Yeah. A whole world full of advertisements. This is a point I want to spend a little time on. Critics of consumerism, fans of consumerism, it all usually revolves around the advertising industry, yeah, or modern life with ads everywhere. Well, first of all, simple question: what's actually the purpose of advertisement? It's not to inform people that there are new goods and where to pick them up. Yeah. Let's say that's the smallest part of advertising, to say, hey, this thing you can now get a hold of, here's where you go and get a hold of it. That's obviously not advertising. And in fact, the whole industry, or this is my claim, would be a total waste of labor if consumption was the purpose of production. If the purpose was to organize production in such a way that as little work is done as possible in order to satisfy people's needs and desires. Think about that. What is the message of every advertisement? Again, not here's a product, here's where you get it, but buy our product, not theirs. Come and get our product, not theirs. Well, that teaches us, first of all, people's poverty doesn't come from the fact that there's not enough stuff. In fact, companies are competing to make the other guy's stuff superfluous. Come and buy our product, not theirs. We want to get them to throw away their goods. It's good if you don't make use of these goods. It might be perfectly good to use. Use ours. Again, advertisement, this whole message, buy our product, not theirs, really refutes the notion that consumption is the purpose. So the question is, how do they do that? How is that done? First rule is get your message out there. Billboards, advertisements, everywhere. I live in Frankfurt at the moment, and I don't think there's a single toilet in the entire city where you're not staring at an advertisement while you're using the bathroom. And it's ironic because I grew up during, let's say, the 1980s at the high point of the Cold War, where we always heard about propaganda in the Eastern Bloc. Apparently, there's even places where there was a radio in the wall, you couldn't turn it off. Everywhere you looked, there was billboards saying, come to the next party Congress, you know, socialism is a worker's paradise, the dictatorship of the proletariat, etc. Propaganda everywhere. And yet, if you compare that with the reality of a modern market economy, people back then were really left in peace. Because said, everywhere you go, there's propaganda for products. Everywhere you go, private propaganda. Well, let's take that. I want to take this comparison seriously for a moment. What is the commonality between advertisements, I'll call that propaganda for products, and, let's say, political propaganda in the Eastern Bloc? The first commonality is a simple lie. And that lie consists in the fact of saying, we're here to serve your needs. It's all about you. Yeah? In both cases, not true. Don't even need to go into the Eastern Bloc. Here, the point of advertisements, they might say, it's all about you. We're here to serve your needs. Clearly, that's not the purpose. It's all about us. It's all about taking advantage of what you have in your pocket. That's the basic lie. And you could say that's a commonality. But there is a crucial difference between, let's say, propaganda back then and propaganda in the modern market economy for products. And that difference consists in what all advertisements appeal to. And what they appeal to is the freedom of the consumer. Well, what is that? What is this thing? The freedom of the consumer. First of all, what it means is that people decide what they want. Nobody forces them to buy this or that product. They're free for themselves to choose what they buy. The second thing, let's say the second element of freedom of the consumer is a little more complicated, or let's say it's a little more general. It's a basic message, which is what you own, let's say what you wear, what you drive, the products that you own, that's a sign of who you are. That's a sign of how successful you are. What you drive shows how successful you are. What you own shows how successful you are. The second point is your success, what you show, shows what a clever person you are, shows how much you're in control of your own destiny. Yeah, shows just how smart you are, how good you are at shopping, or maybe how successful you are at life, what cars you can manage to get a hold of, what clothes you can manage to get a hold of. Freedom of the consumer, therefore, means you choose, it's all about you, and what you buy and how you look and what you show about yourself is proof of who you really are. It's a proof of what a great, successful person you are. That's the appeal to the freedom of the consumer. The first thing is, certainly, consumers have a choice. There's really nobody that forces them to buy anything. There's nobody who says, now you go and buy that. You choose how you budget your money. You choose what shops you go into. You choose what you buy. Nobody forces you to do this. You're free to get a hold of anything. Nor does anybody forbid you from buying certain things. If you have the money, go ahead and get it. Yeah, that's freedom. Of course, what people are not free to do is to get a hold of the goods that they need, even if they're there, even if there's plenty of them, even if there's too much of them. You're not free to do that. Well, what is freedom, then, in this sense? What is the freedom of the consumer? The freedom of the consumer means make do with the means that you have. Freedom of the consumer means not at all you're able to consume well. You're able to satisfy your needs. Freedom of the consumer is not you can satisfy all your needs, but you have to make do on your own. If you don't have enough money to satisfy all your needs, that's nobody else's business. That's your own private affair. That's your freedom. Think about what an abstract, shabby thing freedom is. Nothing to do with how well you actually can consume, how much you have to consume. Rather, it's the point, I'm all on my own. If I don't have enough, well, bad luck. That's the freedom of the consumer. They can choose what they want, but what they actually get a hold of, well, that's a different question. That's why for most people, freedom of the consumer means being restricted to a very, very small portion of the products in the society, usually to the lower end. They can, in principle, get a hold of everything. In reality, because freedom means that they're on their own, they're restricted to the lower, let's say, the lower scale. Consumers themselves, of course, see the matter a little differently. Most consumers would say, well, I might not have a lot of money, and I might not be able to afford everything I need, but it's up to me to decide. They see the enormous amounts of goods on offer, the broad spectrum we just talked about, and they know that they can't afford all of that. But how do consumers praise their own freedom? By saying, it's up to me to decide. Really, they're taking the fact that they're excluded from all kinds of goods that they need and desire, even though they're there, and taking that as a challenge for their own skills in budgeting. I might not be able to afford everything I need, but I'm a good shopper. I know how to make my budget go far. I know how to make ends meet, is the phrase in American English, at least. I know how to get by. Really, they take their own restriction, their own poverty, the necessity of dividing up their money in between, let's say, various different goods, as a challenge for their own freedom. I can go out and show what a clever shopper I am. Not only that, consumers see their consumption as an opportunity to show to others how successful they are. Yeah, I show if I buy the right shirt, I'm successful. If I buy the right car, I'm successful. Show to other people how much I'm the master of my own destiny. And advertisers know exactly how their consumers tick. They know that's exactly how consumers think. Let's say they know exactly what mistake consumers make. Abstracting from the reasons why they're so restricted from such a mass of goods, abstracting from how poorly they might consume, how little they might have, instead saying, yes, but it's up to me to decide. I'm free to decide, and I can decide skillfully. That's exactly the need that people, or the, let's say, the consciousness, the state of mind that advertisers take advantage of. And they do so in a way that's wholly appropriate to the market economy. They make it an offer and demand money in return. Now, this is a rather complicated point. That's why what I would like to do is to go through some of the most famous marketing strategies and see how these points work. The points I want to show are, first of all, how do standard marketing strategies, marketing slogans, what do they tell us about the position of most people? What does that tell us about the reality of most consumers' situation? What I would say is, what does that tell us about their poverty? And the second point is, how do companies make use of that poverty for their own money-making interest? And third, how do consumers think about that? So it's the three points I want to show. The first marketing strategy is obvious. It consists in advertising for a low price. Cheap. Here you can get goods that are cheap. Inexpensive. It's actually a strange advertisement. It might be the most common thing, and in fact, it'd be hard to find products, or let's say most products, that don't say how cheap it is and easy it is to get a hold of them. Now, it's strange. It's the most common advertisement, but it has nothing to do with the product. If something is cheap or not, it has nothing to do with the actual good for sale. Interesting. It's an interesting point. Little musical accompaniment. I like that. So the most common sales argument has nothing to do with the product. It has to do with the ease in getting a hold of the product. How can that be? Well, that presupposes something. That implies that most people have difficulties getting hold of the things they need. It presupposes a lot of people don't quite have enough to make ends meet. Maybe they don't have nearly enough to make ends meet. And because of that general situation, that poverty, cheap is the best argument. So that reflects the poverty of most people. Second point is, companies take advantage of that poverty by saying, you might not have a whole lot of money. You can hardly make ends meet, but here you can buy something cheap. Turn that into an opportunity for us. Third point is, how do most consumers think, I'm a clever shopper. I know where the cheapest prices are. I know where to get the lowest prices. I know when to buy the right plane tickets. I get there cheaper than anybody else. Especially nowadays, there's all these kind of advertisements for different flight company or plane company. What's the word? Airlines. There's the word. Different websites you can go to get there the cheapest. And they compare. They show a picture of people in a plane and compare how much people paid. Yeah. And always the clever guys are the ones who manage to pay the least. Again, people are poor. They can't buy the things they need. But what do? They turn that into an opportunity to show what clever shoppers they are. Second point, very popular advertising, especially when it comes to selling food nowadays. Quality. We have a quality product, not the cheap crap like the other guys have. Organic foods. Think about that for a second. What does that presuppose? That presupposes that normally people can't get a hold of anything of quality. Look, we have a quality product. Apparently, that's not something that's self-evident. You would think that in a rational society, production for the purpose of fulfilling people's needs, every good would be quality. Here, apparently, quality is a special advertising argument that presupposes that normally what people get a hold of, what people can actually afford, is crap. Quality. Again, organic products is really the best example of that. Think of that. A whole segment of agricultural production advertises for themselves by pointing out that you don't get sick from their goods. There's no chemicals in their goods. That tells us a lot about the purpose of production. It's obviously not for consumers. The fact that companies argue for their products by pointing out that they're high quality proves that most of the stuff is crap. Second, what did they do with that? Yeah, the other stuff might be crap. Normally, you can't afford anything of any quality. But with us, you can afford quality. Get quality from us. Don't be like the other saps that buy the crap. You know what's good for you. You know that you need to buy good food to be healthy. Buy our product. And that's pretty much exactly how consumers think about it. I don't fall for the cheap crap. I buy healthy. Yeah, everybody else buys in Aldi and somewhere else, and they might think that they're getting away cheap, but really, if you want to spend less money in the long run, you have to pay more money now. Again, they take the, let's say, ridiculous situation of the market economy revealed by this sales argument and turn it into a challenge for their own cleverness. I'm a clever shopper. I buy what I really need or what's good for me, what suits me. The next one, there's a whole segment of products and a whole segment of advertising that explicitly refer to the crappy situation most people are in, to how poor people are, how stressed they are, how overworked they are, how little time they have, how sick they are all the time. Medication. This whole genre of advertising. Things like, you know you can't afford to be sick. You know that if you could lose your job, if you're sick, take our headache medication. You'll be fine. You know you don't have time to cook your kids a good meal. You don't have time to do all that crap. Buy stuff at McDonald's. Feed your family with a little bit of time. You don't have time to go exercise on the weekends. You don't have the money to go exercise on the weekends. Go out into the woods, take a vacation. Buy our home exercise machine. Really, this just makes the same point explicit I've been talking about. All of these advertisements refer to how poor, overworked, stressed people are. Of course, not as a critique, but as an opportunity to do some business with that, to make an offer. You've got all these problems? Buy the product from us. But probably the most, let's say, widespread form of advertising has to do with brand names. Well, what's that all about? Well, what I pointed out with reference to these other points was really every advertisement, whether they sell cheap goods, quality goods, bargain goods, or goods for compensation, they all contain a basic message. And what that basic message is when you buy a certain product, you show something about yourself. You show that you're unique. You show that you're fashionable. You show that you're in control. You show that you know what you like and you're ready to show it. And the next genre of advertising takes this basic message that is really in every advertisement. Yeah, think of cheap. You know where to find the cheapest products. You know you need quality. They take this message and make that into a part of the product itself. That's brand names. Not just shoes, Nikes. Not just computer, a Mac. not just a bag, it's a Prada bag. Not just a car, a Mercedes, and so on and so forth. The idea is when you have or wear our product, then you don't just say something about yourself as a shopper, but about yourself as a person. And this image is really the point of this advertising. The product itself is not so important. The starting point might be a certain level of quality, but it goes far beyond that. The product is really the bearer of this certain image. The point is to show something about yourself just by wearing shoes. Something that has four wheels and you drive is all of a sudden supposed to say something about you as a person. Show that you're rich, show that you're smart, show that you're cool, show that you're independent or unique. Or rebellious. And usually that's exactly how consumers think about the issue. Buy a certain product, I show that I'm in. Yeah, I show that I'm in the in crowd. Or I show that I don't just follow the crowd. I show that I know what's cool nowadays, and I know what's no longer cool. And the next, and this is the last genre of advertising I want to talk about, the step to the next genre of advertising is actually a really small one. And what it consists in is taking that message of every advertisement, show something about yourself, and making that into the entire product. This is the genre of so-called lifestyle advertising. These are the famous commercials where you have a hard time even finding the product in the advertisement. Yeah, so you're not just buying a Coca-Cola, you're buying that Coca-Cola feeling. You're not just buying a Bex, you're buying the feeling of being out on a sailing boat with all of your friends. If you buy a certain kind of deodorant or a certain kind of aftershave, you're irresistible to women. Or if you buy a certain kind of perfume as a woman, you're totally mysterious and strange. And, or really, you buy into a way of life when you buy this certain product. Now, everybody likes to make fun of these kinds of advertisements. It's really easy to point out how ridiculous that is. Yeah. And nobody really thinks that when they buy a certain kind of aftershave that they'll really be irresistible to women. Nobody really thinks that by buying a Coca-Cola, they'll have that Coca-Cola feeling and everything will be great and loud music will play. But what is true is that when people go and shop, when people go and buy things, their interest is not just to get a hold of this or that good, but their interest is really to prove what's fantastic, free, successful, in control individuals they are. That's something that really is true, and that is something that advertisers take advantage of. The other point I want to say is it's easy to make fun of all these goods, of let's say lifestyle advertising. Everybody likes to make fun of them. I don't know anyone who would actually fall for these kind of things. But what I want to point out is that the principle that's at work in lifestyle advertising, show something about yourself when you buy these products, is the exact same principle that's at work even in the most basic advertisement for cheap, inexpensive, or high-quality goods. It's the same thing. So, to summarize my second part, the question was, what is the reality of consumerism? What does consumption look like if it's a means for making money? To summarize, I could say, on the one hand, like I said, an immense variety of goods of all kinds and intense competition over consumers with all different kinds of means. On the other hand, very different abilities to get hold of products. Lots of unfulfilled needs. Lots of needs that are fulfilled very poorly. along with the extensive satisfaction of very, very luxurious, strange needs. And in that sense, there's a nice correspondence between a hierarchy of goods of different quality and class society, a hierarchy of different social statuses. In that sense, the world of consumerism is a reflection of a world of rich and poor, a class society. That's the reality of modern consumerism. Not excessive materialism. Not everybody wanting to have everything. If that was the point, there certainly wouldn't be any poverty. Now, consumerism is not massive consumption or overconsumption. Consumerism is the world in which needs are mobilized and taken advantage of for making money. That's not the same thing as satisfying needs. But despite all their differences, so let's say beside the differences between rich consumers and poor consumers, they do have one thing in common. And that's this ideology I've been emphasizing. Regardless of how well I can consume, or I can get a hold of the need, get a hold of the goods I need for my consumption, it's all about my freedom. It's all about finding what really suits me. Completely abstracted from whether they can actually get what they need, why they are poor, why they can't get a hold of what they want. Everything is a challenge for their own skills and budgeting. That's the end of my second part. The next part I wanted to talk about the ideology of, or what I would call the ideology of anti-consumerism. Are there any questions before that?
Are you making a causal claim about the status-oriented nature of society and capitalism? You say that you're tracing the causation back to the fact that people want status, and that's also true of capitalists, which is why they want to accumulate more than they can consume, and so that's where you get the accumulation problem as well.
No. No, would you claim that?
Not necessarily. I thought that's what you were doing.
If I understood you quite properly, you wanted to ask me, do I think that, let's say, the cause of what I call class society, would be people's certain consciousness, the desire to show status? Yeah, was the idea. Yeah. No, that's not the point. What I would say is that the notion that is becoming more and more popular nowadays, which is anti-consumerism, says exactly that. That's a mistake I would criticize. It's also something I'll get to right away, but to emphasize my point again, before I get to that, the cause of poverty has nothing to do with whether people want status or not. It has nothing to do with whether some people want to drive a Mercedes, other people don't get to. Poverty comes from something else. Poverty comes from the fact, not that there's a lack of goods, but because people can only get a hold of goods if they have money. What does that teach us? That teaches us that the satisfaction of needs is subordinated to the purpose of making money. If you don't have the money to satisfy even the most basic needs, even if you have no worries about status in your head, you can't buy products. And you don't even get an income. You don't even earn money. Regardless of what you think about status, you can't even get a hold of money to buy anything unless you're useful for profit as a worker. And how are you useful for profit? How can I go out and be useful for profit? It's first of all not my decision. A company has to be able to say, I can use your labor. Now let's say the company chooses to use my labor. What does my income depend upon? Well, my wages are a cost factor. This was the first point I dealt with. I'm useful for profit to the degree that I earn very little and work very much. What a shabby source of income. I can't get it unless I'm useful for profit. And I'm useful for profit to the degree that I can hardly use this money because I get so little of it and I work a whole lot. That's the cause of poverty. Nothing to do with what people have in their heads. The emphasis that I put on people's desire to have status, I didn't want to say that that's the cause of it. Rather, I would say that's a false way, or that's a false attitude about this reality. Lots of people are poor and they know it. Lots of people know that they can't afford all the different goods that exist. They know that they're restricted to, let's say, the lower level of the hierarchy of goods. But my experience, and this is frustrating, is the way people think about that. They don't say, well, why am I so poor? What is production about in this society? Obviously, it's not about satisfying my needs. What is the purpose of production? What is my role in that? These would be objective questions I would encourage people to ask, because I think the answer would be, well, I'm a dependent variable on the calculations of others. Most people don't think that way. Most people say, I know I can't afford much, but I have the freedom to decide. I might not be able to afford lots of things, but the important thing is to prove that I'm a clever shopper. The important thing is to look for those bargains, look for quality, show how successful I am in managing my time. Or maybe there's a different conclusion most people would draw. They would say, I might not have a lot of money, but it's important to show that I have a lot of money. Or not a lot of, but to show that I'm successful. Go out and buy something that shows I'm successful. Clearly, that's not the cause of their poverty. That's an attempt to, let's say, cover up their poverty. To say, I might not have a lot of money. The important thing is to show that I'm not poor, that I'm not a sucker.
Why couldn't it be the cause of their poverty? Couldn't you argue that the cause of poverty is also seeking differential wages?
Say something more about that?
Well, I mean, if you don't think that wages, and I'm assuming you don't, if you don't think that wages are somehow proportional to the contribution that we each make to production, mm-hmm. but we do observe wages at different levels, and they're not random, so what generates them is the ability of certain groups in society to organize themselves in such a way as to make their labor priced more highly by having a relative monopoly in it. For example, trade unions do this, mm-hmm. the law society does this, lawyers are very effective at creating a monopoly in that kind of labor, so they bid up their wages. Mm-hmm. And all of this is about relative status as well, in a sense. I mean, not to say that you can exchange different kinds of labor willy-nilly, mm-hmm. but if you reject the notion that wage comes from marginal productivity of labor, which you have to do if you reject the notion that profit comes from marginal productivity
yeah.
of capital.
I do reject that notion.
You still need to explain where they come from. And
where wage differences come from.
Yeah, and where mm-hmm. differential profits come from.
Right.
And that's what I was suggesting that you were suggesting was could be traced to status. Like status is a common, what's the constant here? Or is it all just capitalism?
Your point was that, okay, how do we explain differences in wages and differences in profits?
Yeah.
And your idea was this derives from status thinking? Or the idea of wanting to have status, wanting to have more stuff?
Well, differential capture of value by different groups of actors on a value chain. So, mm-hmm. you know, lots of different kinds of labor are involved in producing a product like an iPhone or something.
Right.
Away from the Chinese people who made it, to the designers in Cupertino, to the lawyers who argued about it, and the shippers and everything. And
right.
If you think their wages are not proportional to their contributions to the finished product,
right.
So
clearly
they're not.
Yeah.
Then there must be some other explanation. It's to do with their ability to, if you like, sabotage the production of that product by withdrawing their labor. And that's to do with the relative amount of competition at each point on the chain. And is that to do, can that be traced to status?
But before you get to this last point, maybe the way you express it is wouldn't quite agree with, but in essence I would agree with the following point. You said difference in, we're getting off into a different topic here, but maybe we should talk about it a little more later. Let me just make one little point, yeah? You had pointed out how the amount of money people make is not a factor of how much they contribute to a certain product. There's lots of examples that show that would be ridiculous. So the example you had, let's say children working in China, you know, how long to build an entire or to make a shoe, the money that the lawyers make just by making a phone call. Clearly that's not the point. The point is wages are determined by a wild competition. Yeah, everybody tries to get as much for their work as possible, and capitalists try to pay as little as possible. And depending on the power relations, you get a whole different set of wages. Yeah. throughout the world. What workers earn in one country might be different from what they earn in another country. What workers in one sector earn might be different from workers in another sector. The one point I would emphasize about that is, well, the first point that we agree upon, it emphasizes how little production or this process of production has anything to do with satisfying the needs of these people. Nothing to do with them. The point is to pay as little as possible in order to get as high a price on the other end. Where or what determines the different set of wages is a wild, antagonistic competition between producers. That's really the explanation. That's where that comes from. Your point is, does that come from status? I would simply say no. I think that that's all you need in order to explain that, is let's say that hard economic reality. That's really a reason to criticize capitalism, really to condemn it. Say, what an irrational mode of production in which what people have from it is determined by competition, by how much they can, let's say, screw the other guy, would be the moralistic way of saying it. Yeah. Any other questions before I move on to the idea of anti-consumerism? Okay, third point. As I said at the beginning, there's really no disagreement about the fact that we live in a time when everything revolves around consumers. Yeah? This is the common mistake that everybody makes. Disagreements are about whether that's a good or a bad thing, and nowadays, it seems that the majority thinks, or let's say, a growing majority of people think that's a bad thing. Critique of consumption, or critics of consumerism, are certainly more and more popular. And at first sight, I think, how can you criticize consumption? The one thing they would criticize about capitalism is consumption. How is that possible? The only purpose of production, the only rational purpose of production at all would be consumption, the fact that people can consume stuff. The only rational point to produce something is to be able to consume it later, yeah? Or to produce things that can produce other things that can be consumed. So these people criticize consumption. It's first of all strange. Now one could say they're not just criticizing consumption per se. They're criticizing the kind of consumption that you can find in this society, the kind of consumption you find in a modern market economy. What does that look like? What does this critique look like? There's lots of different examples, and for me, the most representative group is a group called Adbusters. I'm not sure if anybody's ever heard of that. They organize something called Buy Nothing Day once a year, and that's not the only thing they do. That's more a symbolic issue. Buy Nothing Day is one day a year, nobody should buy anything. Yeah? Stop consuming. Generally, their theory is that the problems of, let's say, the modern world, environmental destruction, poverty in the third world, overwork, stress in the first world, also poverty in the first world, all of this is due to overconsumption, to massive consumption, especially in North America, also in Western Europe. One advertisement that I saw for this Buy Nothing Day said, 1/5 of the world's richest people, so these would be the people in North America, is responsible for 86% of consumption, leaving only 14% to the other 4/5 of the population. So the idea is because we, in the quotation marks, consume so much stuff, we leave the people in the third world so little. Because these people consume so much, these people have so little. Because these people throw away so much stuff, the others have so little. Let me say something about this first basic argument, because in a certain sense, this covers a whole range of anti-consumerism, this basic idea. Because the rich countries consume so much, the others have so little. The first point I want to make is this fact, yeah, let's say this gap between rich and poor, is not a matter of how much people in the first world consume. It's a reflection of the purpose of production. If people in the first world stopped buying things, stopped consuming stuff, the stuff doesn't get shipped to Africa. Starving people in Africa wouldn't get one more thing to eat if people in the first world stopped eating or started eating less. The poverty of people in the third world doesn't come from the fact that there's not enough and one group is eating too much of it. Poverty in the third world comes from the fact that these people have no money. And because they have no money, they can't get a hold of the goods that would even be available there. Their poverty, their inability to consume, is not because of consumption in the first world. It's because of the purpose of production everywhere. If they're not useful for profit, they don't get any money. And if they don't have any money, they don't get any goods. That's the explanation for poverty. It's the basic, simple explanation for poverty in the third world. They're excluded from the things they need and can only get a hold of those goods if they have money. But nothing changes about that if people in the first world consume less. In fact, because that's the case, because these people's livelihood is dependent upon their usefulness or profit, that's why it's even the case that, let's say, all of us here stopped buying and consuming goods, or started consuming a lot less. Not only would not get any better for these people, in a lot of cases, it even gets worse. Think of the famous argument, yeah, but if people in the first world start consuming, well, then it's not profitable for companies, so they won't hire people in the third world, so these people won't have any jobs at all, so they won't have anything to consume. You can't want that, can you? Well, what is that a reflection of? Again, it's a reflection of the fact that their livelihood is dependent on their usefulness for profit. Yeah, they're dependent on companies making profits. If companies can't make profits because people here don't consume so much, well, then these people have no economic significance at all. Again, the general point is the poverty of these people is not a result of consumption in the first world. It's a result of the purpose of production in all parts of the world. That's the really, we could say, 90% of the ideology of anti-consumerism. Let's say 50%. The other 50% is because we in the first world consume so much, we destroy the environment. The planet simply can't take so much consumption. Can't take the amount of waste that's thrown out every year. Can't take the fact that products are sent back and forth across the globe on ships, on planes, the amount of CO2 that's burned off in production and transportation. If the whole world consumed like that, the planet would simply be destroyed. My critique of that idea is, again, the destruction of the environment is not a result of consumption per se. There's no reason why people consuming stuff, why people in producing and consuming stuff should necessarily stand in contrast to the interest in preserving the environment. There's no reason why that should imply the destruction of the environment. If production in the first world destroys the environment, then it's not because of consumption, but because of the purpose of production. That consists in turning money into more money. What does that mean? That means production has to be cheap. That means that things need to be produced, parts of different products need to be produced in the places they get produced cheapest. That means sending goods from one corner to the globe and back again, transporting them back and forth until it all gets together because labor is cheaper here for certain things, labor is cheaper there for other things. That's one example. Another example, often people refer to the enormous amount of waste, the enormous amount of stuff that gets thrown out every year. Well, if I remember back to what I said about an hour ago, this issue of planned obsolescence. Why is it that computers, as soon as there's a slightly better computer on the market, you don't change the microchip, you throw out the whole computer, and you buy a new product? That's not because people are materialists, because people want to get hold of goods. That's because of the business calculation, which dictates the following. Well, we could, of course, just change the microchip, but much more money could be made if it's impossible to repair it and buy a new computer. Yeah, that's really the source of industrial waste. Something like planned obsolescence. Waste is cheaper. Because production is cheap, this also means using the environment as a cheap trash can. All kinds of different examples. Any kind of environmental precautions. It just costs too much money. That's not a result of consumption, people wanting to have stuff. That's a result of companies wanting to produce cheap and sell expensive. It's that purpose of production that creates this environmental destruction, not people just wanting to have stuff. finally, one last point. The idea about, let's say, the idea at the heart of the anti-consumerist ideology is something I've referred to actually throughout the talk. And that is, they ask the question, why do people consume so much stuff? Why? It's because they're so materialistic. People are just so materialistic. They want more and more stuff. And because people want more and more and more stuff, they destroy the environment. People are so well-fed. Yeah, they're not poor. They have everything that they need and more, consuming all kinds of stuff. The fact that their lives revolve around shopping, yeah, is proof of the fact of how well-off they are. But what I wanted to show when I was talking about the different marketing strategies is that the way that consumers think when they go and buy is not a reflection of how well the materialism is served, of how well-off they are. Every argument for consumers to buy and the way consumers think themselves is a reflection of their poverty. Think about it again. What are the advertisements for sales? It's cheap. Reflection of their poverty. High quality. A reflection of the fact that normally they don't get good stuff. No time? Buy this product. You have a headache and you certainly can't be sick tomorrow? Buy this product. And when people say, I'm a clever consumer, it's not because they say, I managed to fulfill my needs great in a fantastic way and get all the stuff I need. Really, consumer pride is, I might not have a lot of stuff, or I might not have a lot of money, but I can make that money go a long way. Consumers' pride has to do with their skills in budgeting their limited resources, their skills in managing their own poverty. That kind of materialism isn't a reflection of wealth, certainly not of too much wealth, and not even of materialism. That's a reflection of poverty. That's a reflection of the fact that people know that they have to deal with limited resources, don't criticize it, but develop a pride in their success in doing that. Another example of that, I said at the beginning, shopping is one of the best, or let's say most popular hobbies nowadays. People love to go shopping. This is also usually taken as proof of the fact of how materialistic this society is. Well, why do people enjoy shopping so much? First of all, I'm going to say it's a strange thing. The act of getting a hold of something is more interesting than the product itself. Yeah, the act of going out and actually purchasing something is, let's say, the primary enjoyment, and what you actually get and what you do with the product is a secondary enjoyment. First of all, think, what a strange world. But there's a reason for that. I think that the reason for that, that people enjoy this act of purchase so much, is precisely the fact that they're normally excluded from these things. The joy consists in overcoming an exclusion, overcoming the fact that normally I'd be excluded from these products. This time I think I'm going to spoil myself. And for a lot of people, it's really also the idea of just fantasizing about the things that you could have. That's window shopping. Walking along and saying, this is something I could have. Let me imagine myself having that. These are all reflections on the fact that they're excluded from these goods normally. The fact that getting a hold of these goods is not something that's self-evident, obvious, boring, even bothersome. Yeah? You actually have to go get it. It's the whole enjoyment. Think about how much people enjoy that exception to the rule, getting to get a hold of something. Enjoying the fact that they're not excluded, and now I have access to something. So again, this thing, shopping as a hobby, normally taken to be a sign of excessive materialism. My claim is it's in fact a reflection of their poverty. Maybe one more point. Take the other proof for excessive materialism. People define who they are by what they buy. Buying lots and lots of stuff shows what a great person you are, shows how successful you are, how skillful you are. To me, it seems clear this interest in getting hold of lots and lots of goods is not simply the interest in having stuff, but really compensating for your normal everyday life. Going out and getting lots and lots of stuff, I'm in control now. I can actually buy something I want. It's not the boss telling me what to do. It's not other people telling me what to do all the time. That's what I have in my workaday life. Now it's the weekend. Now it's time to go out and, let's say, exercise my freedom. It's time to really go out and show that I'm the one in control. And even more important, going out and proving to others that I'm in control. proving to others what a successful person I am. These are all different, let's say, false ways of coping with the fact that this mode of production, this economy, is not all about them, it's about taking advantage of them. Because of that fact, because consumption isn't the problem, let's say consumerism isn't the problem, consumption isn't the cause of environmental destruction, it's also not the cause of poverty in the third world. That's why the most popular anti-consumerist proposals are so wrong-headed, why they're a mistake. I already pointed out why buying less doesn't help those who have nothing. Their poverty doesn't come from a lack of stuff, it's a lack of money. But this argument is also extraordinarily submissive and modest. Think about what counts as overconsumption. Pretty much everything beyond just having, let's say, a warm roof or a warm house, a roof over your head, food and drink. Everything beyond that is excessive. They don't all measure, let's say, a good standard of living according to the possibilities of production, according to productive forces, but according to what is a minimum. Satisfied materialism is people just getting by. For me, that's far too little. Second of all, most important point. Buy nothing day, or fair trade, or boycotts. Very common anti-consumerist proposals. By going out and not buying things, by buying more consciously, we force companies to produce things that we want. We force companies to not destroy the environment. We force companies to pay their workers more. I don't really want to go into the point about whether all these means or whether all these methods are effective or not. I don't think that they are. But more important than that, think about how absurd that is. In order for production to serve the needs of consumers, in order for production to not ruin the people that produce, in order for production to not ruin the environment, it's necessary to fight against the producers. It's necessary for consumers to stand up and resist, to fight back against the producers. What a strange thing. In this society, production and consumption don't go hand in hand. It's not the case that you organize the production in such a way that it satisfies the consumers and doesn't destroy the basis of all life. Rather, in order for production to be rational at all, or let's say to treat its producers a little better or not destroy the environment, you need to do something like a strike. What that reflects is the antagonism at the heart of this mode of production. Production and consumption are in conflict with each other. In order for production to be rational, consumers have to abstain from consuming. They have to stand up and fight against the producers. And this conflict, which is at the heart of the market economy, the capitalist system of production, this conflict between production and consumption isn't changed at all by not buying something. It doesn't get changed at all by buying less. That antagonism remains in place. Therefore, also the reasons for poverty of people, not only in the third world, also in the first world, and the destruction of the environment. Are there any questions? Comments? Objections? Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to address one of the first points that you focused on. Basic motivation for production, just to make money. And that was your, like the thing that was present a lot of times in your speech was that this is the main problem.
Yeah.
That production is only exists in order to make money, not to fulfill the needs of people.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't see what the problem is. You know, if I go down and open a little shop,
yes,
and start selling stuff, it's natural that I do have expectations for my business to make profits for me. I want money out of this so that I can fulfill my own needs.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see any problem in companies wanting to maximize their profit. I see the problem as a more basic one, more fundamental. A problem related not to how individuals run
market system allows companies to take control, of resources that are necessary for a whole population, meaning that, that companies are the ones who de facto control society as to how much people have to use, whether we talk money or products, you know, to the need. So companies become powerful. There is this freedom of ownership, economic freedom in capitalism. And just as you pointed out, that freedom, consumers' freedom, is actually false freedom. It blocks, actually, it hinders the ability to think independently outside the framework of the companies wanting to profit on your needs and exploit your needs. And I think the same goes for the economic freedom. The economic freedom allows companies to take hold of resources and services that should be available to all people. So you cannot change the situation by changing the way that companies are run, or by forcing individuals to open shops and start companies only to fulfill the needs of others. I believe that you need to have a completely different system, an economic system that doesn't leave the distribution of wealth to the magic hand of Adam Smith, the invisible hand, or to the companies to decide the destiny of millions or even billions of people. Mm-hmm. What kind of alternative would you propose in order to secure the distribution, a fair distribution of wealth, instead of just maximizing the production without any way of securing people's needs? There wasn't any. I didn't see any alternative in your mm-hmm. speech anyway. Now I did read your background and see that you were writing for this Marxist quarterly paper mm-hmm. or whatever. So I believe you have some kind of Marxist solution to the problem. But it would be nice to hear it.
Okay, let me say two things. The first thing is, the first thing you talked about, that you said you don't agree with the idea of, let's say, forcing individuals to, let's say, be more moral in their production or be more ethical. It's a problem connected with the capitalist system. I couldn't agree more.
I didn't say that.
Oh.
I didn't say that people shouldn't be more moral or ethical in their production. That's another question. I just said that the basic problem is not with the companies or their intention of making profit for themselves.
I couldn't agree more. I hope I wasn't misunderstood. Let me put it that way. I mean, first of all, say it's a misunderstanding. I couldn't agree more. My purpose is not to say that whether capitalists are unethical or not, it doesn't matter. The problem is that they're in control of the means of production. Their success is the thing that everything else is dependent upon. And their success means ruining others. I don't want to talk about the individuals. I want to talk about that purpose of production, taking money and turning it into more money. Yeah, that's the problem. 100% agreement with you. Yeah, I also agree that if you want to get rid of the problems that are often, let's say, rid of the unpleasant circumstances that are often attributed to consumerism, yeah, environmental destruction, widespread poverty, overwork. Yeah, there's the only thing to do is then change the entire purpose of production. Yeah, change the purpose of production so that it serves people's needs.
I didn't say that.
You wouldn't say that?
No.
To organize production so that it doesn't serve profit, but to serve people's needs.
You have to differentiate between production and private property of, for instance, a factory or means mm-hmm. of production that I have owned. Mm-hmm. And the political system, which governs and dictates the laws according to which wealth has to be distributed and companies have to run their business and so forth. My point is that private-owned companies are only responsible for the problems that you mentioned, because they are, in fact, in control of not only the means of production, but they're the ones who dictate the political agenda, because freedom, economic freedom means not that you can buy whatever you want, as you said, not that you can, but it means that you can own anything, even things that naturally, it's insane that a person could own this. You see, no one would claim ownership over the sun and tell me that I should pay him every time I take advantage of the sunlight in order to see or go out on a hot summer day. But how then can it be that a resource such as water, drinking water, we have to pay for it. Everybody has to pay for it. People die of thirst. People die from hunger. You know, you have famine all over several continents, you know. And I believe this is the problem. You can't blame the companies alone. You can't blame the purpose of production. You need to look deeper in the roots of the capitalism. Because capitalism is not just an economic idea, an idea about how to run a company. It's a political ideology, and it is in power today, all over the world, basically. And I see the problem more as a political problem than a problem related only to how you should run a company.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. First of all, yeah, I would agree. It's not just not just an economic issue. It's also a political issue. You mentioned a few different things. The first thing was this basic principle of private ownership. It's true. Most people praise that, private ownership. That's the reason that this is a great system. You pointed out what private ownership, first of all, means is exclusion of others from these means, regardless of whether they need them or not. So you mentioned the sun or water. Absolutely basic commodity. Everybody needs it. Private ownership over it, making that good a commodity, private property in that water, means excluding other people from it. Yeah, that's the principle of private property. That's really the irrationality of private property. Maybe we could even agree with me if I said, and that principle is never rational, regardless for what. Private property, this exclusion of other people from goods that they need, is the foundation of the system. That's why it needs to be criticized. It was also really the point I wanted to make in the first point of my talk, is to say, what is the basis of modern poverty? Why is it that people can't get a hold of the wealth that they need? Well, the reason is because of the form that wealth takes. It's private property. It doesn't matter whether they need it or not. It's a matter of who owns it. And if they don't have the means in order to acquire ownership of that money, then they're excluded from it. So, what I mean by altering the purpose of production, what I mean by that is actually, I'm surprised that you say that's not fundamental. What I would say is, altering the purpose of production would mean no longer, let's say, having private property as the wealth, let's say, the form of wealth in the society, where the purpose is accumulating more and more private property. Now, the purpose should be really simple. Determining people's needs, determining the people's desires, organizing the means of production in a way that satisfies everyone, minimizing work, etc., etc. Kind of useless to talk about this because, first of all, I need to get people to understand where the problems in this society come from. And that would get to my point about the alternative. I think that you and me might agree that we have, let's say, a rather radical critique of the market economy. Yeah. The point is, you probably noticed yourself, nobody else thinks that way. Very few people do. That's why my alternative, it's really not an alternative at all, go to other people and explain to them why the problems that they might see everywhere, poverty, overwork, is not because of greedy companies, also not because of excessive materialism, but because of the very basis of this economy, something like private property. That's why I'd say that's, first of all, my entire alternative. If I can get other people to agree to that, if I can get other people to say, wow, you know what, you're right. All these ugly things don't come from immorality, a lack of ethics. They don't come from greedy companies. Really, they come from the nature of private property, of this kind of wealth, and from the purpose of production, the accumulation of private property. Yeah, if I could have people that far, there's no worry about discussing alternatives. But until that point, it just doesn't make sense. I don't have an alternative. Go ahead.
I heard the same thing as the other guys, that the main point they are arguing produce money, and so production can proceed.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it will fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that, I'll ask you if you have heard of the term called post-scarcity economics.
No.
Have
you? No.
Well, there's a few groups in the world that are actually pursuing this idea of science called post-scarcity economics.
Uh-huh.
And the main idea is that scarcity emerges only under condition of scarcity or artificial scarcity. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you probably can't sell air because there's a lot of it. But other stuff that are scarce or held scarce artificially, you can sell. If there were enough, you could sell it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a group in the United States, a lot of North America in the 20s and 30s that predicted that the economy would fall apart because people would, because machines were taking over their people's ability to pay and buy products. Machines took that work so they could fire, so they couldn't make money to pay for stuff. So the economy fell apart. And we had the most severe economic breakdown in the history. You all are aware of it, right?
The Great Depression.
Yeah, the Great Depression. And had it effect. What saved the economy, the world economy, in the World War II, because that made people usable once again. There are lots of different works and were enacted. I mean, people constructed weapons, clothes, everything. So World War II was really great for the monetary price system, because their main idea, this group in North America, was that it's not just the market economics that's a problem. It's a very monetary price system, because there's no way that you can save price system economics. There's no way to save the price system with price system economics, because it's complex with Fisherman's laws, basically, because you can't have prices without producing more and more and more. So inevitably, it will come down. Whatever we do about it, we can do nothing about it, or we can try to enact an alternative to the price system, but whatever we do about it, the price system will come down. That's the main reason for considering these this kind of sciences.
Mm-hmm.
Post-scarcity.
No, I'm not familiar with it.
No.
But maybe one point about that. You were saying the ultimate purpose of this theory is to say at some point this thing has got to collapse.
Yes, no matter what. No matter if it's China, not the United States, Denmark, Argentina, the price system will come down.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe worldwide. Maybe it's happening now. Yeah.
I don't really have an opinion on that. On the one hand, I would say probably not. This is held up. This is a system held up by much more than, let's say, a certain price system. It's held up by lots of means of force. Yeah. But something about the
holds up the price system.
Right. Exactly. You could say it that way. And I would warn against a certain kind of argumentation by saying, because the system is bound to fail, that's why it deserves criticism.
I'm not saying that.
Okay, good. The reason I was thinking about it is it's a very common argument to say, look, this is a non-sustainable system. It's going to collapse at some point.
think that if it's going to come down and collapse, no matter what, I think that's an argument to try and find a solution, because before the problem becomes so severe that our future actually becomes so bleak that it's a complete nightmare.
Uh-huh.
Much worse than what we have now.
Okay.
So,
I think one of the problems, maybe I'd have to take a look at it more, but I don't think I'd agree with the premises, or I can't understand why the price system has just collapsed. But let's say, apart from that, it's bad enough now.
Yes.
Regardless of whether the system itself has contradictions, whether it might run for 100 years or 50 years, regardless of whether the system can't function or not, the way it's functioning now, and it's functioning very well, stands in contradiction to most people's interests. That would be a reason to criticize the system. Not because it might collapse, but because there's a contradiction, a necessary one, between the functioning of the system, of this economic system, of the market economy, the price system, and most people's material interests. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that there are two arguments for pursuing this kind of research. One is the system, if it's true, if the price system will collapse, that's one reason. The other is that if there is an alternative that's much less damaging to the environment and our ability to live on the planet.
Yeah. Right, and I would say long before really the threat to the environment is there, the threat for most people is already here. That would be really the reason to...
Yeah.
And maybe that's a good point because, you know, really I'm not worried about the sustainability of the system, about whether it's going to collapse or not. Yeah. Really, the idea is to point out the antagonism between most people's material interests and the very proper and successful functioning of the system, when it's functioning at its best. That's really the antagonism that needs to be grasped. I think the man getting beer wanted to say... Oh, you go ahead. You wanted to say something for...
Yeah, I wanted to ask you.
Yeah. You didn't even bring me a beer.
Do you want
a beer? No, I'm fine. No, I'm just kidding. It was a bad joke.
So you stated a lot of problems with the capitalist system.
Yeah.
Did you have a solution?
Yes and no. I said a little something to the gentleman sitting over there. What am I doing actually tonight? What am I doing here? Clearly I have certain critiques of the system. They're radical critiques. I think that most of the phenomena that most people complain about, yeah, poverty, environmental destruction, overwork, etc. They're not due to greed, certain people's greed, but to the principle of this economy. Yeah? The subordination of people's livelihood, the subordination of production of goods, of consumption, to the purpose of turning money into more money. That's based on a system of widespread exclusion, and Marx also used the term exploitation. People can only learn a livelihood if they produce more than what... Than if they're deprived of a certain portion of their product. Only if they produce profits. Only then can they live. And they're useful for others to the degree that they earn a little and work a lot.
But
okay.
You're ignoring like donation and altruism. Isn't that a part of it also? Maybe I'm just suggesting that it's not so black and white.
Certainly it's not black and white. Certainly there is something like altruism. What's the problem with altruism? Altruism, first of all, doesn't change anything about these reasons for poverty. It doesn't remove the antagonism, it doesn't remove the exclusion of people from the wealth they need, nor does it change the purpose of production, nor does it change the fact that people's livelihood are a cost factor for producers, nor does it change the fact that if they don't, that they are useful for producers to the degree that they earn a little and work a lot. None of that has changed. Altruism is a way of, let's say, not changing that, but dealing with the necessary consequences of that. Let's say the most generous thing I could say about it is that it doesn't get to the, let's say, it's a nice medical phenomenon. It treats the symptoms, but it doesn't treat the disease. In that sense, I would say, no, altruism is not an alternative. In fact, I think there's plenty of goodwill out there. Every Christmas that comes around, there's tons of different organizations that you can donate to. I even read a book, how the charity industry is now one of the biggest industries. There's plenty of goodwill. There's plenty of people out there doing good things. And yet, nothing is changing. I think I know why. The reason why is because they're not, curing the disease, which is the very nature of the wealth in the society, the very purpose for which it's produced. That's why I don't want to say that altruism doesn't change anything, that it doesn't help at all, but I would say that it's not going after the problem, or the source of the problem.
Would you say the living standards have increased or decreased all over the world in like the last 50 years? Like the living standards for people all over the world, like generally, just would you say that it's generally increased, the living standards, or decreased?
Well, first of all, it depends on where you look. Yeah. Lots of places have gotten much poorer than they were ever before. So 1990, Russia went from a second world country to a third world country. Standards of living have been falling in the first world for a good time now. In other third world countries, they're rising. But what do you want to say about that? I mean, I could say yes in some places, no in other places.
I don't have a solution. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the solution could be. But I just don't think that there's like this evil force just doing evil. Except, I think maybe it's just humans being human and humans exploit each other. And humans help each other sometimes, and of course, I don't see like it's not either moral or amoral, but sometimes people just don't. Maybe they don't consider what you're thinking so much. So people are not as smart as you, and. Perhaps that's why they're acting stupid sometimes.
I don't want to say anything about whether they're as smart as me or stupid as me. but I would say one thing you pointed out. You said maybe people haven't thought about what you're thinking about. Maybe people don't know what you know. And I'd say, actually, I'm certain of that. I don't think that makes me smart. I don't really care about that. But it's true that I do know that and other people don't know that. So what's my solution? Well, to make sure that other people know that. So you do things like organize a talk and go and try to agitate people. Well, why? My conviction is insight into the causes of the problem. That is the best means for finding the solution. Yeah, if there's millions and millions of people who think the same way I do, well, there's no problem. The problem is nobody thinks that way. That's why my solution is not, let's say, to paint a pretty picture for you, how it could look in another world, but to, first of all, convince you. You say you don't know the solution. My purpose would be to convince you that the causes for these problems that I've been talking about are the true causes. That'd be the debate that we should be having. You, and then you over there.
Well, first, thanks very much for a really compelling presentation. And the last point you made, I'd like to push you on a bit, which is about, you said about, you went back to causality again.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the causes? And in the answers you've given to some of the other questions, I want to be more clear about what you think the cause is, because one moment it's private property,
mm-hmm.
and another moment it's private ownership and means of production, and then there's the price system. And which of them is it? I mean, we had private property and we had a price system in feudalism before capitalism. Medieval feudalism had private property and
mm-hmm.
had prices. What it didn't have was private ownership of the means of production
mm-hmm.
in the form of capital.
Mm-hmm.
So is it that? And do you then think causality, because it seems like you're suggesting causality rests in the legal system,
mm-hmm.
and then Other people here are very reluctant to say, well, it's something to do with companies because they're being greedy.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to blame consumers. So, I mean, what's left?
Maybe the point is not to find people to blame.
I mean,
give me a pen.
The question then is one to do with agency and structure as well, of course. I mean, you write for a Marx, some of you said you write for a Marxist magazine, so I'm guessing you're more of a structuralist, but can you please be more specific about what it is in the structure which is key and which can be changed?
Well, maybe I could be more specific about maybe what I think you might mean by structural. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by structuralist.
Well, if it's not the individual companies, mm-hmm, and their desires to maximise profits particularly, if the causality rests somewhere else, it's not individual consumers wanting to be to consume too much, then it must be something structural, which is to do with, you know, the institutional setup and how things fit together. Well, what is it?
That. First of all, you started off by saying, which is it? Is it private property? Is it private ownership in the means of production? Or is it the legal system? To be more specific, I would say it's all three. How do they fit together? First of all, private property. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Private property means everything that exists, all the wealth society, belongs to somebody. Yeah? Regardless if you need it or not, if you don't own it, it already belongs to someone else, you don't get it, unless you can pay them a certain sum of money. So, private property is first of all a form of wealth, which means exclusion of other people from wealth. Okay. Like you said, a feudal system, they had private property but not private ownership of the means of production. Yeah. First of all, if private property means anything you own, other people are excluded from it. Everything other people own, you're excluded from that. Yeah, that's a very antagonistic economic system. Yeah, that's not a system in which people cooperate in order to produce things that they need, yeah, and do the necessary organizational labor to make that happen. Yeah, that's a system where everybody produces in contradiction to the other. Try to get as high as price as possible. Get as high as price as possible. Pay as low a price as possible. Yeah, that's a system of antagonisms. I don't think that's a rational system of production. Private ownership of the means of production, yeah, that's really capitalism. Not only am I excluded from the stuff other people have, but most people are excluded from the means to produce things at all. Private owned the means of production is that a whole group of people can't live at all unless they're useful for other people's production. Yeah, and their purpose is not to satisfy this or that need, but to acquire the means with which you can get a hold of everything, and that's money. It's private ownership of the means of production. Well, what about the legal system? He said, how does that relate? Yeah, the legal system, I would say, the state law, yeah, the law that a state power enforces, that's the entire basis of private property. This economic fact, private property, people are excluded from other things. That's a relation of force. That's not something that some guy can uphold with by being strong or having a gun. Yeah, the system of private property is only something that can work on the basis of, widespread, omnipresent state power enforcing that law. So that would be my very brief introduction to how private property, capitalism, and the state fit together. That would be the structural idea. I'm not sure if that's very helpful for the others, but to give you an idea of the fundamental nature of my critique. There was something over here.
Yeah, I would like to ask, will they find that the production system in general is producing a lot of products we don't need? But that is very general, because don't you think that the human has a part of the innovation, we invented the wheel for some reason,
mm-hmm,
thousands of years ago. So instead of we are producing new products, because we also have the will to innovate and will to find new products, and the companies have an opportunity to free the minds to have capacity to be creative, which capitalism gives an opportunity to do in the private ownership of, in an example, Ford. I think that your speech is, I don't know if you have a copyright to it, but it would be the opportunity to think is a private property. So I think that the
you described, going to make money, is also a part of being humans. Or do you think that all the new products we are making, like a windmill that we make a lot of money in Denmark, or meditation, is only to make money? I think it pays for our healthcare system. It takes for hospitals.
The windmills pay for the hospitals?
Yeah, in general in Denmark, they are. Or the medication that we are producing through taxes.
Okay. Let me start with this last point. Windmills paying for the hospitals. Clearly, the income that comes from the money made by the windmills.
Of course, because of some ideas produced by a part of the society, but it serves a general purpose for all of society.
Yeah. Think about this point. You point out that. Think about it this way. Because of the revenue that's generated by innovation, these windmills, bring in revenue. This allows people to get access to medical service, which they would otherwise not have. Yeah, otherwise they wouldn't be able to afford medical service at all. If you didn't have these windmills generating revenue, people wouldn't have the money in order to get hold of medical services. Yeah. Well, the problem is the solution for which, or let's say, the problem for which money is a solution. Yeah. People otherwise wouldn't be able to pay for medical care. That's a problem that only exists in a society with money.
But still, the possibility that all of us don't have to go in the field and produce something to eat.
Finish that point? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think you have a lot of very interesting points. Yeah. That's what I'm thinking of when I heard your speech, that the part of innovation and all that, that people want some recognition, and you get some recognition from your ideas by getting some copyrights to them or being paid for them in some way. I think that's just part of human nature. So, of course, if you don't want any monetary system at all in society, parts will fall out, of course. So, it's just a commentary to the innovation part of your speech that I think was too general.
Okay, well, let's think about that point on innovation. Certainly what I wouldn't criticize is something like innovation. If the meaning is developing, let's say, newer, more effective products, yeah? Goods that are, let's say, good for satisfying needs in a more efficient way. Yeah? The thing is that in our economy, that's not the purpose of innovation.
I think it is.
Okay.
I think biotech firms, the movement of firms innovated into the green tech industries, start producing cash also for the shareholders and produce some green energy, I think.
Well, certainly, there's lots of innovations you could point to that are incredibly useful. Yeah. I don't want to make a judgment about the intentions, certainly not of the scientists themselves who are coming up with these innovations.
Well, of course, intention of creating money,
at
their shareholders.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe that's the same point, is that your argument is that, look, their general motivation is, of course, to satisfy the shareholders. Yeah? So, but, of course, they're also, that allows, or that generates, let's say, the money needed to bring about great ideas which eventually help people.
Yeah.
But again, the problem that shareholders solve, let's say venture capital solves, is a problem that only exists in a society in which everything is made dependent upon having and earning money. Otherwise, there's no problem. Think about it this way. If companies didn't earn money, or let's say if companies couldn't have intellectual private property, if companies couldn't earn money for the innovations that they bring about, then they wouldn't innovate. Therefore, money allows them to innovate. Well, this whole problem only comes about because nothing can get done unless it's useful for making profits. Because the means to innovate at all, or to turn innovative ideas into reality, the means to make that transition from idea to reality, that's all in the hands of capitalists. That's what it means to own the means of production. Because that's the case, because they have a monopoly on these means, nothing gets done unless they make money. And really what that means is the subordination of innovation, the subordination not only of needs but of innovative products to that purpose. The consequence of that is lots of innovations that never come about. They would be really, really useful. Think of lots of different kind of diseases for which no research is done. One example. Lots of innovative products that could produce things very, very efficiently, but people who don't have the money to pay for it don't get a hold of the innovation. So the system where there's shareholders, but not only shareholders, let's take companies without shareholders. Because these capitalists own the means of production, innovation is supported to their needs. Because that's the case, it's wrong to say money is the motor of these innovations. Money allows these innovations to take place. No, it's just the other way around. These innovations are subordinated to money making. The only reason that intellectual property, the promise of a profit, generates this innovation is because everything's subordinated to profit making anyway. Again, it's a problem, or it's a solution to a problem that only this economy has. And so it shouldn't be praised for that.
I think the system gives the opportunity to do the steps, so it frees some resources. And of course, there are both government support for diseases that are, to take an example, and the private companies also supports research that takes place at the universities because they find that they can have some opportunities to solve problems in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think that capitalist system has proven that it is superior in some ways to others.
Okay.
Not saying that it's the best system, of course.
But it's not the best, or maybe the best, but not a great system.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get to the gentleman behind you.
The same reason why you have never heard about a term like post-classical economics, because you cannot earn money on researching post-classical economics, of course.
Uh-huh.
You can't only earn money on researching ways to prices for economics. This insane snake that bites itself in the tail. I think more people know what I'm talking
about. It could be that I haven't heard of post-classical economics because I'm a lazy researcher. It could also be that.
Yeah, you can say it's a research, but you can't earn money on researching economics that would mean that there can't be no prices there.
No.
Because in post-classical, you can't have prices.
Hmm. Right.
But that's because the academic system is part of the educational setup, which reproduces the ideas which makes capitalism seem legitimate.
Yes.
So is that, you know, we shouldn't be surprised about this, really.
No.
I might be repeating myself, but one last point about this. If I understood you properly, you said the money incentive, is really what allows innovation in the first place. Without, first of all, excluding people from the things that they need, excluding people from the results of innovation, thereby allowing people to make money on it, there would be no innovation in the first place. I would say that's just not, first of all, this is not true. Why should you need that for innovation? Why should you need such a contradictory thing? The exclusion of people from a certain product in order to bring about the product. How is that a natural thing?
I haven't been thinking this as thoroughly as you have, but it was just my thought about innovation. It was very interesting to hear your point of view because I was just thinking that you were too ill, but of course it's not fair to exclude people if you can agree upon that.
Well, it's not really a matter of fairness, and again, I don't want to get at the bad intentions of a certain capitalist. I don't really care what they think. What they think about the innovations they do. In fact, I'm certain that scientists, even companies, think that they're providing a great benefit for mankind. And it is often the case that a lot of products that they produce certainly help a lot of people. The issue I want to get at is that I keep using this phrase. Yeah. The problem which innovation solves. Yeah, let's say people not being able to afford medical services, now they're all of a sudden cheap. Yeah.
Yeah,
African children starving, or let's say dying of AIDS in the third world, even though it would be so cheap to cure them. Now, once you have innovative products that can be, let's say, produced very cheap, they can get a hold of these products. All of these benefits are based on this basic exclusion. And this basic exclusion is not a matter of whether it's fair or not, or whether it's ethical or not. What I want to say is that basic exclusion from the things people need, that's the foundation of this kind of wealth, of private property. That's what ownership, private ownership means, exclusion of others from these things. As, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it's a patent only
grants
for some time.
A what?
When you take patents.
A patent. Yeah.
It only grants for some time. So the money invested by the company will have some years to make themselves in. And then you have to make it free for your goods.
No, the goods don't have to be free. that doesn't make the goods free.
But the idea is so you can produce things really cheap.
Yes. That doesn't change the principle. Certainly. It's true that this knowledge then once again becomes general knowledge. It's no longer the one company that's allowed to make use of that knowledge. All other companies are able to make use of that knowledge. That doesn't mean that the people get a hold of the products. it's a basis for more competition where people can get a hold of them. It doesn't change anything about their exclusion. They have to satisfy another company's profits in order to get a hold of those goods. The second thing is that really underlines that point. Why is there something like intellectual property? Yeah. Knowledge, yeah, technical knowledge, scientific knowledge, is something inherently communist. Why? Because it doesn't cost to share. If I know something and tell you about it, it doesn't cost me anything, it doesn't cost you anything, it's a non-scarce resource. Yeah. So that's exactly the problem with knowledge in capitalism. That's exactly why... you have to have intellectual property here. Why? Because otherwise you wouldn't have the exclusion that you need in order to get a price for it. That's why I would say it's not a good thing that the patents all of a sudden, let's say, run out, yeah, that other people can get a hold of it. First of all, because people are still excluded from it. Second of all, because it really underlines this fact. Yeah. You really need to create a system of exclusion of knowledge, let's say, to generate artificial scarcity, yeah, so that it's useful. Yeah, that's a condemnation of the system.
So you create artificial scarcity of knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's the leverage you need in order to make money on it. That's actually a very nice example of the principle we're talking about. Anything else? Yeah, go ahead.
I think one more point about these groups saying that one idea is that a price is not, I still talk about this idea, that it has only worked for so long now because of a huge industry on the entertainment or consuming world. Many wars I'm sorry to say this, but the United States has been the main.
I'm not sorry to hear it.
country that has fought wars everywhere on taking a profit for wars. The wars itself is the main industry that keeps the prices alive. That's
I guess I would agree to you to in one point at that. Let's say without permanent, this would be a point that we'd have to talk about in more detail. But I'll say it as a claim, yeah, as a statement. Yeah, it's something I said about this legal system. The basis of this economic form of wealth, private property, yeah, is ubiquitous, omnipresent state force.
Yeah.
Yeah, this establishment of the law, the establishment of this fact that if you don't own it, you don't get a hold of it. If you want to get a hold of it, you have to pay money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that only works on the basis of omnipresent state force. Yeah, that's the one thing. The second thing is this whole thing, price system, yeah, system of private property. It's not only an economic issue, it's like the gentleman said before, it is a political issue. It's a political issue in the sense that this economic system is also the basis for a form of state rule, a form of state power. Modern state powers draw their resources from exactly this kind of an economy. And in order for that to work out, in order to, let's say, harness the capitalist system for the purposes of state power, America makes very clear, without a global system of control, yeah, without a, let's say, a level of power to be able to obligate all other countries to subordinate their, let's say, the livelihood of their citizens, the livelihood of their people, without a state power that forces other state powers to subordinate everything in market economy, then it's apparently, for America, not a reliable source of state power. Now, in that sense, one could say the whole system functions only on the basis of the permanent readiness for war, and it's also a reason for war. But again, this is my statement, not so much an explanation. Maybe we could talk about that in a different talk. I'm open for invitations.
You said that like sharing knowledge between scientists was a communist thing, or what? Did I get it right? But I think like there's a lot of economy in that, because if you retain knowledge as a scientist, you can gain fame and street respect is really important for scientists. So you have like a scarcity issue also in science. So I don't think like it's all altruistic in science. Also.
No. Certainly not. The point, I didn't want to talk so much about scientists, but really to make a joke about, and it's a true joke, about the nature of knowledge, that knowledge, let's say actual, yeah, knowledge, not so much those who know, but the knowledge itself, it's something, it's a non-exclusive resource. Yeah. The more people have it, doesn't take away from the others. And again, that's the very irrational thing about this economic system. That's precisely the problem. With knowledge. Therefore, in order to be able to make that into a commodity, in order to make it into something that's useful for the purposes that do dominate here, which would be to turn money into more money, the first thing you need to do is be able to exclude others from that knowledge. Again, it's an especially drastic illustration, maybe, of this principle,